Tomorrow marks the 50-year anniversary of a major event that took place here in Kansas City. On November 15, 1967, a young man from Mexico by the name of Primitivo Garcia was leaving his English class at Westport High School when he saw his teacher being attacked by muggers. Without a moment's hesitation, he rushed over to help her, he fended off the attackers, and he saved his teacher's life. But he himself wasn't so lucky. Primitivo Garcia, or TiVo, was fatally shot. He spent 13 days in the hospital, and during that time, Kansas Cityans donated blood trying to help him the way he'd helped his teacher. It was a big story for the whole city, actually, for the country. Time magazine published an article about the immigrant who saved his teacher's life. The mayor declared December 1st Primitivo Garcia Day, and the governor of Missouri made him an honorary citizen. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're going to find out what the story of Primitivo Garcia meant to people back then and what he still means to us now on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm joined to begin with by Primitivo's sister, Irene, who got the phone call telling the family that Primitivo had been shot. Irene, hello.
Hello. My name is Irene Garcia Mendez, and I'm the youngest of 14 of the Garcia family.
Yeah, and this memory must be really poignant and difficult for you. How old were you when all of this happened?
We had just gotten here from Mexico. We came from Mexico, and I had just graduated from grade school and to a new life. We came here in the summer. I think Primitivo came like in February, and we came here during the summer, and so I had started school. And
where did you live?
We lived in Chihuahua, Mexico.
In Kansas City, though, like what neighborhood did you live in?
We came to the west side. It didn't take long for Primitivo and my brother Alfredo to put down a payment on the house. So we already lived on in a house on the west side on 27th and Holly.
That your older brothers had bought?
Right.
What brought you all to Kansas City, and how had they worked their way to buying the family a house?
I had an aunt that lived here in the United States way before I was born, and so she encouraged my family. She wanted a better life for my family. We're very poor in Mexico, and she encouraged my oldest brother to come here and helped him get here. And then that brother helped the next brother and the next one and the next one until they were all here except for Primitivo, Alfredo, and myself and my mom.
And then the rest of you came. What was that like? What was that last sort of reunion, I guess, of all of you and your two remaining brothers and your mom coming over?
It was wonderful because my father passed away just like about 3 years before we came. And that's when my mother decided, okay, what are we doing here? The rest of the family, they're in Kansas City. We need to go. And my mother's dream was always a better life for us. And so that's why we came, for a better life. And like I said, Primitivo came a few months before we did. Alfredo, myself, and my mother, we came the summer of 67th. And
what do you remember about your brother, his personality, what he did, what he liked, that kind of stuff?
My brother was a wonderful person with a wonderful personality. He was just very good looking, first of all, and he was very likable, very respectful. He spoiled me because I was the youngest,
How did he spoil you?
Every time I got good grades, he would buy me something, or if he would go out of town to work somewhere, he would bring me something.
What kind of work did he do?
He worked, what I can remember, he was like a manager for a construction company. But like I said, we were very poor, so he did a lot of other things growing up before I was born.
Why was he taking English classes?
Education was very important to him. And so right away when he came to the United States, his goal was to learn English and to go to college and to get a better education, because he felt like a better education is the key to a better life.
Well, so, I mean, I know this is hard, but tell me about getting that phone call.
I remember the phone call like if it was yesterday. You know, I couldn't speak English very well. When I came from Mexico, I couldn't speak a word of English. And we had only been here a few months. And all I can remember is the teacher saying, it was the teacher that called. And I answered the phone. And all I can remember her saying is, "Your brother's a hero, your brother's a hero." And I was just trying to understand, you know, like, what does she mean, my brother's a hero, you know? And so I was really confused. But that's all I can remember. I'm sure after that, you know, they had already called an ambulance and they had already taken him to General Hospital. But I don't remember much about that phone call other than hearing, you know, "Your brother's a hero, your brother's a hero."
I'm going to come right back to you, Irene, but Primitivo's teacher, the one whose life he saved, is on the line with us now. She lives in California, and we're going to let her tell this story from her point of view. Margaret Kelso, good morning.
Good morning.
Can you believe it's been 15 years? 50. It's been 50 years.
Yeah, some days it just seems like yesterday, and other days it seems like 100 years.
Tell me about November 15th, 1967, as you remember it.
Well, it started out just like any other day. I was teaching my naturalization classes, and Primitivo and his brother, Alfredo, took my class together, and they always sat in the first row. I can picture them there right now, to my left, and they were very, very intense students, and they never missed a day. And Primitivo would occasionally try to talk a little bit in English, and Alfredo was still at the stage where he was pretty much observing, you know, wanting to hear it a little bit more before he branched out. And as I was leaving the school, I noticed that there were in the hall there were waste baskets overturned, and usually, you know, they clean up after the school. But I thought, well, that's odd. You know, there's trash all over the halls, and a lot of people were leaving at the same time, and there were a lot of people at the exit. And I was waiting for my sister-in-law to come pick me up. And some boys came whooping out of the school. And then they were, you know, making catcalls and going, "Ooh-ee," and stuff like that, and dancing around me. And then one of them took my purse, and they were throwing it to another kid. And these were teenage boys. They, you know, ranged from age 14 to 19, I learned later. And so I didn't really think anything of it. In 1967, women who were isolated and kind of alone often got catcalls from construction workers or a group of men who were gathered around a bar or something. And I just thought, oh, dear, you know. But it's important not to engage them, and so I didn't go, you know, answering them or anything like that. I just kind of waited for it to be over, and then they threw the purse, and they weren't trying to steal my purse. They were just using it to taunt me. because, you know, if they wanted to steal the purse, they would have grabbed it and taken off. But they threw it across the street. It landed on the street. And I thought, well, okay, the whole thing's over now. And I walked across to get my purse. And then it wasn't over. They all came running. They knocked me down. They started molesting me and groping me. And I was really frightened, because, especially since I was 6 months pregnant. And it was, you know, it was pretty scary. And so then none of these bystanders did squat.
Who else was around other than these guys who are taunting you and evidently Primitivo Garcia and his brother, who will eventually come running? But who else was there?
There were multiple people leaving the exit. Some of them were waiting for rides, and some of them were walking to their cars. And we were all leaving at the same time. Classes got out at 9 o'clock. And it wasn't just the naturalization council classes, but it was also the basic education and GED classes and adult literacy classes. And
So this is 9 at night. This is night school is letting out.
Yes. It's a night school for adults.
And so you were saying none of these people did squat.
They didn't do anything.
When did you notice that two of your students were kind of on their way to help?
I didn't notice them at all. They weren't in that group. They were Alfredo and Primitivo were waiting for the 39th Street bus. I don't know if you know the location of where Westport is. But I was at the Locust exit, one of the side exits. The main exit is on 39th Street, but I went off on out the side exit. And Alfredo and Primitivo were waiting at 39th, across the street on 39th Street. And so way from far away, they saw me. They came running, and I really didn't realize what was happening until they pulled the guys off of me. And then I was so relieved. It was like, oh, my gosh. And I got up. I had my purse with me now, and I just walked back to the school. And so I didn't actually see the end of the fight, and I never saw anything about a gun. Until from across the street where I was standing, I saw the gunfire. I heard the pop and I saw the flame go horizontally. And then I saw all the boys running away.
Margaret,
And then I saw Alfredo and Primitivo walking toward me, and Primitivo was holding his side. But he was walking on his own. And they came over, and he lay down on the cold cement, and I put my coat on top of him. And I just kind of stood there not knowing what to do. And Alfredo, who was always reluctant to speak English in class, communicated with me in good enough English that I could say that I understood. And he said, "You call the ambulance." Of course, this is way before cell phones. I will stay here with Primitivo. So I ran back to the door that I came out of on Locust Street, and it was locked by now. So I ran around the corner to the main entrance, and I barged into the office and just went straight for the phone, didn't say anything to anybody, and called the police. And then my head was beginning to clear a little bit, and the office workers told me that this gang of boys had come harassing and acting up in the office, and then that they had been the ones who had dumped the trash cans. So they were very angry.
Margaret Kelso, you, just to remind our listeners, you were a teacher. You taught a naturalization class. You taught English to people who wanted to become citizens. And the story that you're telling us is about the night that some attackers greeted you outside the school, and two of your students intervened, Primitivo and Alfredo Garcia, and that Primitivo was killed in this interaction. He didn't die that day. He was in the hospital for about 13 days. What do you remember about how the city responded to this story in those 13 days?
The Kansas City was very, very proud, and they took up a collection. And one of the reasons they were proud is just a few years earlier, a similar situation had happened in New York, the Kitty Genovese case, where bystanders had done nothing. And we were proud that here in Kansas City, we did have somebody who did try to help. And they made a fund, and Primitivo had been taken to General Hospital. The fund paid for him to go to St. Mary's, and then it also paid for a scholarship that was given every year at Westport High School. And it was a big deal in Kansas City.
You know, can you tell me a little bit more about your students? Who was a part of this class in general, and maybe how people viewed the English language learners striving for citizenship in your classes in 1967?
I think in 1967, there was less anger toward immigrants than there is these days. I think there's a subset of people in our country who blame immigrants for things they shouldn't be blamed for. But my class, Primitivo and Alfredo were the youngest people in the class. My class was composed of people from all over the world. So it was not like a bilingual class where I spoke partly in Spanish and partly in English. I had to speak completely in English. And if people didn't understand, we had to help each other understand with gestures or repeating in a different way or slowing down. The people from all over the world, one of the reasons I love teaching ESL, English as a Second Language, is that in most countries outside of the United States, teachers are revered and honored in a way that's different from the way people sometimes treat teachers in the United States. And so I was definitely revered and honored in that class.
Do you remember placing the call to the Garcia household and speaking with Irene Garcia that day?
Yes, and I remember something else about Irene. She said she didn't speak English very well, but my Spanish was very limited. And Gregoria, the mother, she didn't speak a word of English. And Primitivo and Alfredo were just learning English. They both had jobs, but they didn't have, but Irene had been going to school for a few months and had this total immersion in English. And she was the translator when I went over to her house. And she was just a young, I don't know, I'm picturing like middle school, a young teen. You can ask her.
Yeah, Irene, how old were you again?
I had just graduated from grade school, and I started seventh grade here.
Yes,
so
that's
I don't
what I'm
know,
thinking.
12, 13.
And Irene was the translator when I would visit their house. And they were very hospitable toward me. And when I visited in the hospital, Primitivo said, it's okay. Thank you for being my teacher. He was so nice. And the Garcias were so nice. And they showed me some of Primitivo's artwork. And, you know, and it was nice to get to know them in a way that was, they're lovely people. And Irene, who was saying that she hardly spoke any English, she spoke more English than I could speak Spanish. I would rely on her. Yes, I had to repeat my, well, it's not a good call to get. I had to repeat myself and say it slowly.
Irene, I want to go back to this time for you too. When do you remember those 13 days and how people responded and to what was happening and what your brother had done?
Yes. We were very, very surprised how the city, you know, the world, because we did receive a lot of letters in the mail on a daily basis. The mailman would come with a bag of letters, you know, from all over the country. And it was on the news. I mean, I wasn't surprised at what my brother did, because he had done that all his life. He could not see any injustices. He could not stand to see someone needing help and not do something.
Irene, we're going to be right back with you. But Margaret Kelso, thank you so much for speaking to us from your new home in California. I'm sorry for the difficult memories. I'm glad you made it out okay.
Well, thank you.
This is a song about Primitivo Garcia sung by some grade schoolers. When we return, we'll hear about the importance of Primitivo Garcia's memory in our own time 50 years later. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back.
Listen now, and you will know. This is the story, the true story of Primitivo Garcia.
We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about Primitivo Garcia, who was fatally shot outside Westport High School 50 years ago. The young man was an immigrant from Mexico who was at the school to learn English in hopes of becoming an American citizen. On his way out, he saw his teacher being attacked. He intervened, and he saved his teacher's life, but ultimately sacrificed his own. We heard from the teacher earlier in the show. She lives in California now, and his sister Irene, who's still with us now. Hi, Irene.
Hi.
And you were just telling us about some letters. I know you don't have those with you, but what are the kinds of things that people wrote to you and your family about how your brother's story touched them?
It was a lot of encouragement, you know, like, it's a great thing what your brother did, and he's a hero. And a lot of children also wrote letters, and they were coming, you know, like I said, in so many, in bunches. We had
people were donating blood, right?
Right. People up to this day come up to me and say, I never donated blood before, but I did on that, you know, for Primitivo. So they were very proud that, you know, lines of people, you know, were lined up just to give blood so that they can save him. But anyway, yeah, it was amazing that the way that the whole country and the city of Kansas City reacted to my brother's heroism.
I want to hear now from Primitivo's niece, Monica, because she didn't actually know her uncle, but his memory means something to her. And it seems like she wants her generation and people younger than her to take something from the story, too. Hi, Monica.
Hi.
What is it about this story that feels important to you?
I think a lot of elements are important, but right now, I think inspiring young people and giving them somebody to look up to, giving them a role model, giving them an example of what we all can be. And, you know, sharing his story, sharing his legacy, letting people know that Mexicans are good people. Primitivo was an amazing and wonderful person. So sort of spreading the love and spreading the vision of a good people with good heart, because that's what Primitivo stood for. That's who he was. And I do think that our children and our grandchildren need a role model, the Hispanic community, the Latino community. These children need to say, I can be like Primitivo.
Although, on the one hand, that's a beautiful thing because he was someone who didn't allow himself to be a bystander, letting someone else be hurt. His story does end sadly, you know, he died. And I'm curious what it is about him. I mean, looking at this story of how he saved his teacher is one thing. But what else about him do you think that makes him a role model?
Makes him a role model while giving the ultimate. But aside from that, you know, my aunt Irene and several of the family members always talk about how correct and appropriate and well-mannered he always was, how jovial and happy he always was. Just what a fun, loving, and respectful person. You know, Margaret talked about it was typical back in those days for women to get catcalled. My mother specifically told me stories of how Primitivo would say, stop it, you know, don't be respectful. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the vision that I have of him. And that's the side that I want to share and for people to know. That's why it's important for me to share his story.
How did you first learn about your uncle Primitivo? How did you first hear this story?
Well, there was a picture of Primitivo in our living room wall. For as long as I can remember, I remember the picture and I remember hearing the story. But because my grandmother's, you know, grief and her pain, she was never the same after the loss of her son. We didn't really talk about it. It wasn't an open topic, an open conversation. But I remember looking at that picture, you know, being that little girl, 5, 7, 10 years old, looking at that picture, and he was just so handsome. He was movie star beautiful. And it's funny how a picture of somebody can also project kindness and a gentleness about him. And then, you know, we would ask questions and sometimes they would get answered. I remember being hushed, you know, because we didn't want to hurt my grandmother or make her cry. So we couldn't ask in front of her. And I think when I got older, I started asking more questions. And after that 25-year mark, when Joe Arce did the 2-part televised story and it came about that, you know, the family got together and asked for the school.
Primitivo Garcia Elementary School.
Primitivo Garcia. It was initially the Primitivo Garcia World Language School. And that was a very proud moment. That's when it turned in from, I think, the pain and the loss to celebrating and commemorating and honoring. And it turned into something beautiful. So I think in life, we have a choice to focus on the negative, the pain, the suffering, or how can we turn this into a blessing? How can we honor his sacrifice? How can we honor his memory? And that definitely is by, you know, sharing the legacy, by remembering him, by not allowing it to have been in vain, in, you know, being an inspiration.
You wrote about him in Chicken Soup for the Latino Soul. How did you approach that?
You know, it's funny the way synchronicity works, is the way I like to call it, or, you know, spirit, God, whatever you want to call it. But I've always had a passion and a love for writing. And I sort of reached a point where I said, man, I think I need to publish something or stop calling myself a writer. And right after that, like a couple of days later, I received an email, last call. for stories for the Chicken Soup for the Latino Soul book. And I just kind of threw it together. I made some phone calls. I started doing research. I asked a lot of questions. And, you know, it going back to the school and the inauguration of the school, I remember walking through the halls and I remember thinking, you as his niece have the responsibility now to share his story. What are you going to do? And I just remember feeling that I needed to do something. It was something I needed to do in my life, was to share his story and to put it out there and to continue on his legacy. So when I get the call, last call for Stories for the Chicken Soup for the Latino Soul book, it was a no-brainer. I knew what story I was going to write. That was already in me as something I had to do. And I didn't have it. The crazy thing is I didn't have any doubt about it being selected. There was thousands of submissions and I knew Primitivo's story had to be shared. So I knew it would be. And it did. It was.
Have you heard anything from someone, just a total stranger, someone who wasn't alive that time or wasn't in Kansas City, someone who would have no reason to be personally connected to him, but who responded to his story in a way that they needed to get in touch with you about it?
I have, you know, in the book, maybe I put my email there. I'm not sure if I put my email there. I have it on the website. There's different places that, and I have received emails saying, you know, I came across a story, or even family members, really, family members that are maybe a little bit more distant, maybe cousins, have written to me, relatives that I probably, you know, haven't interacted with physically, but they've emailed me and they just have said, thank you for sharing his story. It just touched me. I'm so honored. I was so happy to read it.
Monica,
I'm so proud of you.
Yeah. As we think about Kansas City and even America in 2017, do you think this story takes on new significance and new meaning?
I mean, I do. I think now more than ever, it's so important to share his story. I think the best way to counteract the negativity is with the positive story. I think there's enough negative stories and there's enough hate being spread and there's enough of, you know, the ugliness, that what can we do to share the beauty and the love and the good? And now more than ever, you would think that 50 years later, we would be in a better place. And his story is such a restoration in humanity for anyone that's having doubt in humanity or feeling down. Read Primitivo's story and listen to his story and his legacy and share it, and you will feel uplifted.
Monica Garcia Sanz, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Irene Garcia, thank you.
Thank you.
When we return, a day in the life of a painting conservator, from ordinary days to more unusual discoveries, like finding really old things caked in famous works of art. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's next on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, this is KCUR's Central Standard, and now I'm joined by Mary Schaefer, who usually lives a pretty quiet life outside the media spotlight as a painting conservator at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. But her recent discovery of a grasshopper, or part of a grasshopper, trapped inside a Van Gogh painting has gotten a lot of attention. And that's fair. It is not every day that you find a 128-year-old bug in a revered work of art. Right, Mary?
That's true.
So tell me about the painting itself to begin with.
Yes, well, it's a painting by Van Gogh, as you say. It's called Olive Trees, and it was painted back in 1889. It has the thick paint stroke that you would pick, thick paint strokes that you would associate with Van Gogh's work, and you see the sun shining and casting shadows, and there's all kinds of colors to view, and so I encourage visitors to come take a look.
Well, so this isn't a painting that has been hidden in some dusty corner for years and years. People have, plenty of eyes have looked straight at this thing and not noticed a bug.
Correct. And the painting has been treated. It's been studied over the years. But I'm working on a French paintings catalog, which is allowing me to take a really close look at every single painting in the French collection, take the works out of their frame, study them with all kinds of examination tools.
And in the kind of tools?
We are looking at the paintings with a microscope, with UV radiation, infrared, and x-rays. And when you look at them in this way, you start to gather all of these bits of information about how the work was constructed, what kind of condition it is in. And using the microscope, this is how we came across the grasshopper.
So can you take me to that moment?
Sure. At first, with the microscope, when I came across that section of the foreground, I thought I saw the impression of a leaf, which also fits into this idea of Van Gogh working outside. But when I zeroed in on it with higher magnification, I came across, it became clear that it was an insect.
How did that become clear? I mean, I can imagine that looking at something that is depicting trees, that you would see something look like it's not quite the material of the paint, and your thought would be something kind of tree-like. If someone, Van Gogh standing out among the trees, mm-hmm. what would be likely to fall here? A leaf. Mm-hmm. What was it that you saw that made you like, no, that's not a leaf?
Well, if I can just describe what this is like, when you're looking at it through the microscope, you're seeing Van Gogh's kind of swirling paint. You've got purple and greens and whites kind of intermingling. It's really beautiful. But then you have this indentation, which lines up with the head of the grasshopper. And then you see this linear shape with this really strange angular pattern, and that's part of the leg. And so what led me to realize that this is an insect was sort of the shapes I was seeing. And then, of course, I gasped when I saw this, because it's not every day that I come across a grasshopper. But then I went on the computer and began looking up all these images of grasshoppers. And it just sort of confirmed it, especially with the angular impression of the leg.
Does it change how you personally see this painting or others by Van Gogh to have this moment of, there's something, I guess I think of this revered work of art as something that is very high up on a pedestal. And I think of a segment of a bug as something that one might call kind of ordinary or, I don't know. There's something about having these things together that makes that painting very real and makes the moment when he painted it very real.
Yes, I think it really takes you back to that moment in 1889 when Van Gogh was working out in the olive groves. And I will say that there is something special about this painting that is a real favorite to the visitors at the museum. And so to come across something that we haven't seen before is unusual. I will say, though, that it's not unusual to find this kind of material in the paint. Conservators find this all the time. You can come across sand in the wet paint of a beach scene. There's little fragments of leaf in wooded landscapes. And so here we're sharing this image of the grasshopper, but I will say that I think there's countless bugs and other types of material written up in conservation reports all over.
talk to me about that. I would guess that must be a kind of scenario that you train for in your line of work. You wouldn't predict exactly what you're going to find, but paint as sticky stuff is going to trap things. And I would imagine there's protocol.
Conservators know how to recognize a lot of the materials that they see. You can imagine if an artist has an old brush they're using, that brush is starting to release its the brush hairs, and they get embedded in the paint. That's really common. But even you think of the artist dabbing with their finger, you know, conservators come across fingerprints as well, or swipes in the wet paint with their finger. I've even come across marks in the paint that were made with a cloth from dabbing into the paint.
What does that tell you?
It just tells you a little more about how the artist was operating. But, you know, the conservator is getting really close to the surface to try to learn how they were, you know, what their process was, what tools they were using.
So you can tell the difference between a dab with a cloth and a dab with something else?
Yes. That's the beauty of the microscope. I mean, the view through the microscope of a painting is so different. It can be, it's sort of like when you're looking down from the window seat of a plane and you're seeing that like patchwork of the land below. You know, it's just a really different view. And the same is true with the painting, looking through the microscope.
What made you want to get into this line of work? It's a field that maybe, I'm just guessing there are a lot of people who have never really even thought about this kind of relationship with art that somebody has as their job. How did you find out about it? What got you interested in it?
Well, I first learned of it in high school because my art teacher had a book on all the different departments at a museum. And conservation had a chapter, and I was just fascinated by the idea of touching the art, being close to it, studying it, caring for it. And so I had that in the back of my mind when I went off to college.
It's so funny because for most of us, don't touch the art is just pretty much rule number one for the Sesame Street introduction to you're about to visit the museum for the first time. You know what I mean?
Oh, yes. There's conservators everywhere who, if they hear this, they want to hug you right now.
But the funny thing about that is that the person whose ultimate job is conservator, the person who's protecting the art, that person gets to touch it.
They do, carefully. Yes.
How can you give us some of the sort of behind the scenes on how you touch a work of art in a way that is safe? Not that we're all going to go out and do it. We're not going to go out and do it.
Well, maybe I should describe some of the concerns I had when I first began touching art. And this was before I had a master's degree in art conservation. I was being trained, and I remember having, you know, some stress in terms of what could happen. And so...
Yeah, because this is sort of the world's treasures.
Yes, yes. And you can come up with all kinds of scenarios. I mean, I've seen paintings that came off the wall because the floors were I can't remember now how it happened, but a painting came off the wall in someone's home, and that painting went through a bedpost. You know, when art comes off walls and is moved, bad things can happen. And so you constantly think about where are you going with the art? And have you already set up that space? And make sure that there isn't busy traffic. You know, at the museum, anytime the art goes through the hallways and is being moved, everybody sort of steps aside and lets the art pass first, just to make sure we don't have any accidents and no one has glasses of coffee nearby. But you do think about that, and you eventually get to a point where that comes second nature.
But tell me about when you were being trained. And so you had all these ideas in your mind with... How did you get over that enough to carry on with your training?
Well, I think that if you want to play out worst case scenarios in your mind, that, you know, that for me became how I really became careful. You know, if you start to think, oh, if I pick up this painting and I move it, where's the corner of the table? Because that could become a problem. And so you just are taking your time. And because you're very nervous, I think it heightens your senses and making sure that you don't cause any damage. So what's funny is that I have work stress dreams occasionally, and they involve art, and they're crazy. I once dreamt that I spilled red wine on a Degas pastel. And how in the world am I going to explain this at work?
Yeah, that would be a tough one.
You know, you can have some really fun dreams related to art and damage.
But do you remember the first time you actually did touch a work of art?
I do. I was doing a pre-program internship at the High Museum of Art in Atlanta, and they don't start you out on the art. You know, you have no skills, but you need to get experience working with a conservator. And I, at first, was just cutting foam board. And they wanted really nice clean cuts, and I was able to pass that hurdle. And then I got to clean a gilded frame that had been in a fire, and so there was soot. And so I removed all of that. And then I got to graduate up to removing the soot and grime from the painting associated with the frame. And of course, the conservator I was working with had tested everything, made sure that there was no way that I could cause any damage. And I began to clean the soot off. And after I did that, it's a very repetitive process. Some might consider it a bit tedious, but you're slowly removing this black material and you reveal the colors. And afterwards, she turned to me and said, "Do you want to be a conservator?" And I was like, "Oh, yes, I'm in."
Do you remember, just zooming in on that experience a little bit more, it's hard for me to imagine what it would be like to see the color in a painting revealed like that, mm-hmm. one little bit at a time. Can you take me to that a little bit more closely? Like what your eyes saw, how that's not how most of us see famous paintings. We just walk in and the whole thing is there.
Mm-hmm. So I guess this is to your point about how art conservation is very behind the scenes. The visitor is often just seen it in a perfect, you know, gallery, good shape. When something like this with the soot is being removed, you're using a cotton swab. You're using a material that you have determined is safe for the paint. Every painting is different. So you have to be very careful. But then as you're working, you're checking that swab for any color, any sign that suddenly something dangerous is happening and you're getting color off. And then you're also removing that dark material. It's going onto that swab. And you're slowly working from one side to the next. And the original colors are starting to be apparent.
That seems like a really cool way. Do you remember stepping back and at a certain moment being like, "Whoa, this painting looks totally different now"?
Oh, for that first painting, I was just pinching myself the whole time. I mean, I was just having so much fun. And that there are moments in my job that I have those moments again. I mean, it's just, you never know what you're going to find, what you're going to do on a day-to-day basis. And you're surrounded by these really beautiful, special art objects.
So when you talk about that, all the time you're finding things. You're finding specks of sand in a beach scene or whatever, traces of the artist's finger. How do you know the difference between this is something I will log down, but it's all in a day's work, and this is something that people are going to care about? This is a big deal. This changes something. This is a grasshopper in a Van Gogh.
Well, in this case, I think that while it's not unusual to find this in a Van Gogh painting produced outside, it does become this really fun way for museum visitors to engage with the painting, think about how Van Gogh was operating outside, battling the elements. He talked about the challenges of working outside with the bugs and the strong winds. And then he has this wet canvas. He's got to traipse back through the fields to a studio. And so it becomes a way to talk about his process and all the different scenarios for how this grasshopper landed in the paint.
Do you have some other, maybe even smaller moment, something, I don't know, where something arguably mundane, some little detail has actually astounded you as you're looking closely at a work of art and felt like a revelation?
I get excited by all kinds of things. I get excited by incised lines made into the wet paint by the artist, a signature that was faint, but you can use a tool to reveal it. So that, I think that's why I really love this job.
Our time is up, but Mary Schaefer, with us from the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art, thank you for taking us inside the life of a painting conservator. And tell me, you know, you found this grasshopper or part of one in a Van Gogh painting, olive trees. Is that on display now?
Actually, it's going to be off view tomorrow, but then it will be back up Thursday and onward. And so we encourage people to come take a look.
What's going to happen to it tomorrow?
I'm going to spend some more time with some scientists examining it.
Very, very cool. Mary Schaefer, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
You can listen back to this conversation and anything else you've heard on our show at kcur.org/Central Standard. Earlier today, we talked about the story of Primitivo Garcia. Tomorrow, we'll be back with a show on clutter and whether it's really all bad. We question that assumption, starting with a place called Scraps KC. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Tom Taylor. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next, so don't miss it.